25th, 2021. We're still complying with governor's executive order, so masks will be required while indoors during this meeting, unless you're at the podium with 6 foot distance to speak. If I may start by taking roll call, appreciate that. President Wolburn?
Here.
Vice President Hickman?
Present.
Director Starr?
Here.
Director Moreland?
Here.
Director Edwards?
Here.
Council Cooper?
Here.
Information Systems Manager Martinez?
Here.
Environmental Health and Safety Manager Perrin?
Here.
Finance Manager Wong?
Here.
Power Division Manager Leon?
Here.
Regulatory and Compliance McKillop?
Here.
And myself, General Manager Mosley. Who else do we have online?
For employees, we have John Shipman.
Okay.
Charles, who I assume is Charles Sharp.
Okay.
Dr. Gretchen Moore. John Kinsey. Paul McGovern. And five anonymous.
And anonymous. Okay, and as in previous months, will you, after the board meeting, send me a list so I have the names correctly to identify?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Do you have a pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. President, if I may, I'd like to request a change in the sequence of today's agenda that was posted.
Okay.
So I'd like to request consideration after we go through tab one, approval of minutes. We move tab four, business items, which is the mutual aid agreement ratification, under item F up, and then continue on down the agenda from there, if you don't mind.
Fine with that.
All right.
So let's start with approval of minutes. Any questions or concerns about the minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes as written. They look very good.
First and second. Any comments from the public?
Nothing received as of 2:06 in the public relations email.
Nothing on one.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, Eric. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Aye. So we have five ayes. All right. So let's go ahead and move that tab four.
Thank you. Tab four is a business item today, which is seeking ratification of historical mutual aid agreement between South Feather Water Power Agency and North Eagle Water District. A couple of things before I start. You'll notice an insert in your board packet. So when I converted the mutual aid document, there were a few sentences within there that had ASCII character changes. So I've included a clean version in your board packet, and we also addressed that and posted on our website last Friday, a clean version as well, so there's no confusion on a few of those sentences that had ASCII characters. I don't think any of you were actually board directors in 1996, but in the later years you were, so I'm going to walk through what this ratification is about in a little more detail now that we have all five board directors present in the board meeting. Versus committee folks, and give you a little bit of background as to why we're requesting this ratification today. And so, Art, would you mind putting a PowerPoint slide for me, please?
Absolutely. 1 second. Share the screen with everyone.
So we can see that in the boardroom. Are those participating via Zoom able to also view this document?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So I'll give you a little bit of background leading up to this mutual aid agreement, if you don't mind. And this starts with South Feather provided, which is also in your board packet there, a letter in regards to offering assistance to our neighboring water district for evaluation or repairs of the Upper Forbestown ditch system specifically to improve water conveyance, ability to increase water conveyance and decrease losses within that system. So that's what this particular tab is about. So I'll give you guys a little bit of background if you don't mind. Art, would you go to the next slide? So what we're referring to here on the Upper Forbestown ditch, this is a schematic of the entire irrigation system. And so prior to the beginning of 2011, South Feather Water Power Agency, previously known as Orville Wyandotte Irrigation District, was responsible for all of the irrigation system you see on that map, so all the varying colors. Then as we entered into 2011, which what is known as the 2005 agreement, the area circled in red is identified in the purple line there as the Upper Forbestown Ditch. And that ditch and its responsibility was then transferred through quitclaim over to North Yuba Water District. So this topic, this mutual aid discussion today, is specific to the area circled in red. Well, next slide, please. So again, a little bit about background there. So since formation in 1919, South Feather owned, operated, repaired, and maintained this Upper Forbestown Ditch, referred to as UFD. Geology and soils of the Upper Forbestown Ditch were actually included in the Agricultural Water Management Plan that was prepared by eco-analysts in 1986. So that was the mechanism from 86 moving forward that we used to understand soil types throughout all of our different irrigation systems, what types of crops were being used, and how to efficiently and effectively maintain such conveyance systems. The analysis provided the foundation for appropriate maintenance targets, etc. And then South Feather performed regular maintenance on that ditch up to, like I said, up to 2011, the transfer to North Yuba Water District. So if you go to the next slide. So what type of maintenance did we perform, just like we do with all the rest of our open ditch conveyance systems? That's mechanical cleaning, vegetation management, shotcrete lining, repair replacement of flumes as necessary, diversion system enhancements, and vertical shoring of embankments. And vertical shoring of embankments is key with much of what we do with these older conveyance systems. From 2011 to date, from all of our records, it appears that minimal preventive maintenance has been performed on the Upper Forbestown Ditch. And as a result, South Feather is willing to offer under our mutual aid agreement, originated in 1996, had an amendment in 2003, and an additional amendment in 3 and 6, and the scope of our offering is to improve the reliability of the ditch and increase water conveyance if North Yuba Water District chooses to accept the offer under this mutual aid. South Feather operational staff, so how do we do this just real quick? We have 4 ditch tenders, 3 equipment operators, 3 laborers, a carpenter, construction foreman, maintenance foreman, which would all work on the project to identify improvements and reliability of the ditch. And then we would exercise and utilize advanced technology to diagnose and perform a variety of maintenance and repair techniques, which I will speak to here in a moment. Next slide, Art. So what's our project value proposition that we've presented under the spirit of the mutual aid agreement? Is we have project description, we have current condition, what our target condition is, which is increased water delivery and decreased losses. So what are some of the key events and milestones if North Yuba is to accept a willing hand under the mutual aid? We perform visual inspection of the ditch system. We would measure and plot in quarter mile increments water loss. We would prioritize those locations and identify what type of repair techniques are appropriate based on each physical location. And then we'd overlay a strategic plan to increase water conveyance up to 30 CFS. And then we would begin maintenance and repair immediately, assuming acceptance with our neighboring partner here. And we'd apply the 80-20 rule, right? So for this year, since we're already in the hot season, we would identify and target the largest opportunities for improvement first, and then discuss and work on proposals moving forward for the future irrigation seasons and conveyance seasons as well to then continue to make more improvements. So what resource needs do we need? We obviously need North Yuba sponsorship to the mutual aid. And then we would go out and source a little bit of ground penetrating radar and 3D scanning, which I'll talk about in a minute, but that would start in 2022 and beyond if we were allowed to participate. What would our tracking metrics be for success? Be cost, schedule, performance, and then the project risk overall is medium, and that's really tied to physical access to some of the locations, which makes that a medium versus a low risk category. To give you a forecast of investment ideas, we stand here today for this year, fiscal year 21. I believe it'll be about $186,000 investment this year between labor, equipment, and materials. 2022-23, we're forecasting about $224,000 per year, and then to be determined beyond that based on, you know, that level of effort over the next 3 years. Next slide, please. So again, to highlight what we're talking about, this is now a zoomed-in view of the circle on the map that I previously started off with. And so you'll see at the top right-hand corner, SF-14, which you hear a lot about, which is a diversion point. There is a natural tributary that feeds in called Oral Leaf Creek, and this is the ditch system that runs down the system. So from about the middle of that map to the right is really the target areas that we would be working on up to what's called an Acosta Creek diversion point. That would be the focus in 21 if given the opportunity to assist. Next slide. So what are some of our means and methods and why would we go about doing it this way? So 3D laser scanning, I think most of you are familiar with that, but that develops, gives us a scan of the topography so we know what we're dealing with throughout the system. Again, that would be 2022 and beyond. And then ground penetrating radar gives us the ability to identify subsurface elements. And that's important when you're talking about those things that aren't visual to your eye but are creating increased losses. Those are holes and roots, rodents, those types of things. We perform mechanical grooming, which there's actually a science and technique to that, which I won't bore you all with today, but there is a specific way of doing that that does not compromise the current ditch system. Vertical shoring, that can be precast concrete, metal, a number of methods for vertical shoring on weak spots, low points, etc. Shotcrete lining, which obviously you guys know, you sponsor, and we perform a fair amount of shotcrete lining with an open conveyance in the district where access allows. And then the technology, which you see in that lower left picture there, is concrete cloth. So this is used for small areas, plugs, rock fissures, etc. That's basically a concrete embedded fabric. You put it in place, you plug a hole, you wet it, and it hardens, and it captures very quickly any type of losses within the system. Art, next slide, please. So, again, what we're asking for in this tab is to ratify as this board the mutual aid that already stands, and then, you know, upon acceptance, anticipated acceptance from North Yuba Water District, we'd work cooperatively to meet the things I've just discussed prior. If you go to the content within your board packet, you'll see the actual mutual aid agreements that talk about our ability to partner in situations like this. The 1996, if you go to page 2, item 3, you'll see there that that item says that the two districts may wish to enter into cooperative agreements for the development of additional water supplies, maintenance of existing facilities, and or improvements and or reconstruction of the existing facilities in order to enhance and improve the economics of delivering water to their respective customers. So that's really what we're discussing here, what we're offering. A couple of you board directors are aware of this offer. We're bringing it to you today for all five of you to ask questions and then seek approval to formally ratify if indeed North Yuba chooses to accept our offer so that we can move forward immediately without having to call an additional special board meeting, etc. I believe council has some comments on the language I put for the recommended form of action.
Yeah, this is Dustin Cooper, agency counsel. On the dais is a letter from under my letterhead, you know, outlining the offer of mutual aid assistance under the existing mutual aid agreement. So part of the ratification action today is ratifying that offer that was made in consultation with staff and under my letterhead. Normally, obviously, we would like to present this to the board and seek your approval in advance of making an offer such as this. But under these circumstances, the timing just wouldn't allow for that. There is existing litigation between some landowners within North Yuba Water District and the district itself, and there was an injunction request made to the court. So this letter was written within the time constraints of that injunction filing. And as an offer that we see as a win-win-win, Obviously, South Feather has an interest in a viable Upper Forbes Town ditch that, you know, we have we share a ditch system. It's, while we no longer maintain the Upper Forbes Town ditch, we serve customers off the Upper Forbes Town ditch and then also receive water up to 11 CFS at WD6. So we have an interest in this facility being operable. The win that we see to North Yuba is the ability to deliver water to their customers, and obviously that's an important thing, not just for their crop needs and such, but also for to mitigate an already pretty critical fire risk in a year like this. So again, I guess our apologies for going out a bit on a limb and making this offer, but part of the recommended action today is for you to ratify this offer. It then goes to North Yuba, and whether they decide to take us up on this offer or not, that'll be up to that board. But but the action for you today is to ratify the offer.
Two comments.
Yes.
Ms. Frenay is first one.
Yes, Ms. Frenay.
Hello, this is Monique Frenay from Oregon House. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
Wonderful. I can't stop saying things like thank you and thank you and thank you. It is amazing. We are involved in the litigation for being delivered irrigation water or not. And it's been amazing to read in a letter that the letter you sent, that this phrase that said, even in the drought, there is enough water available in the reservoirs to run irrigation. I trust that you have all the data on that. We came to that same conclusion by math and by thinking and math and thinking. It's very different if customers try to find out what's going on, or if you guys, big agency next door, actually have that data and can put such a letter together. In all the math exercises that we did, the little bit of increased capacity of the Forbes Town ditch from 22 to 24 would already help us so much, and the little bit of reduction that you guys have been proposing to not take 11 CFS but use less would give us math-wise the number of CFS needed to run a small irrigation system or a modest irrigation. We're just immensely grateful. I have two questions. Do you have a ballpark or an estimate of how many days of what would be for you guys to raise capacity from 22 to 24 again?
Yeah, so your first question, so if the mutual aid agreement was approved, for example, today, the first thing South Feather would do is we would go up to SF-14, which you see on the map, that gauging station, and we would overlay what water is currently flowing through the Oral Leave Creek tributary, and we'd make sure that the sum of those two areas equal 24 CFS. So why do I say it that way? Because as I stand here right now, there is 16 cubic feet per second being released at SF-14. So I can assume that 8 CFS is still traveling through the oral leave process to then equal the 24 to then start traveling down the ditch. So immediately, next day from approval, we would make sure that at least 24 CFS is traveling down the upper stretch of that ditch. At that point, we would then immediately start analyzing through visual inspection, like I mentioned earlier, areas that are low spots. In this case, what we're talking about is areas to prevent overtopping or erosion. And I won't get into too many details, but picture the upper half of the ditch dry right now. We need to make sure as it gets wet, it doesn't create a problem. So we would tackle that, but I would anticipate within 13 to 15 days, we would at least be able to deliver at a high capacity to the Costa Creek diversion point, and then open up that diversion point, and then see how it travels from there.
Thank you. It's music to our ears, but it's also sort of half impossible to believe that you can be that effective. I have another question. It's more about the history. Like, when you were maintaining the ditch yearly, did the Upper Corps on ditch capacity ever dip under 24? Was that a normal thing, or is it really only from not being maintained in the last 10 years?
Yeah. So that's a complicated question. Let me see if I can answer it easily. So the original ditch design capacity was forecasted at 50 cubic feet per second, 50. Years and years ago, it's our understanding that there were times in which it neared 40 cubic feet per second. The reality is, though, in today's climate, 2021, compared to 1856 when that ditch was originally created, 24 is about the maximum as it stands right now for the entire system. There are locations within that value stream that could be higher, but there's locations that need to be improved in order to increase above 24. So right now, with doing nothing, 24 would be your max. There needs to be maintenance performed.
Right, because right now we all the time hear that it cannot be 24, cannot be. Anyway, I can only end my little comment by thanking you for being so incredibly competent.
Thank you for the kind words. Now we have a second public participant with questions.
We have two more. Charles was next.
Okay.
Mr. Sharp.
Hello. Thank you. Yes, I'll start at Morgan's house. We'd like to thank Tom Feather for your office to the Secretary of the I don't know why the directors of the North Carolina District don't see attention to the exception of this office at this time. Tomorrow, I am organizing a 1-hour meeting for the District. I've invited your control manager to the District. I think he can. 30 samples is good, but our work is good. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp.
And then Mr. Kinsey.
Mr. Kinsey.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is John Kinsey with Langdre Jones Helsley, and I represent many of the landowners or irrigators within North Yuma Water District. And we strongly support staff's recommendation. And really appreciate the thought that you put into to this. Forbestown Ditch obviously is critically important to landowners. You heard from two of my clients today. It is capable of supplementing their water supplies in dry years, and in years like this, it's absolutely critical to get every drop of water that the district can to the irrigators. And North Yuba, fortunately, has significant water supplies available to it. The issue is one of capacity. And today, North Yuba's leadership has presented the piping of the Forbestown Ditch as really the only option to increase capacity. Their message to my clients, frankly, has been support the Forbestown Ditch piping project or you're not going to get water. And because of that, we really appreciate this May 7th letter because it demonstrates that my clients have been presented with a false choice. It's a capacity issue of North Yuba's own making, in our opinion, due to its affirmative neglect of the facility. And more importantly, South Feather's letter demonstrates that a significant expansion of capacity can be achieved for a relatively modest expense. I mean, with the offset that's being contemplated, there's really no money that should be coming out of pocket for North Yuba. So we think this is just a win-win-win. It's a common sense solution. And, frankly, these are the types of actions by governmental agencies that should be the norm. Everyone working together for the common benefit. We strongly support South Feather's ratification of this offer. And if made, we strongly encourage North Yuba to accept it. It would be a very positive first step to toward repairing the relationship between North Yuba and the irrigators. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other public questions or comments?
What do you think?
This is Donna Corson.
Hi, Ms. Corson.
Hi, I want to say thank you. I appreciate all your efforts to work for and with the customers of the Yuba Water District in such a wonderful way. Thank you. Really, truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Floor?
Thank you. I'm here representing myself as a private citizen today. Want to get that on the record, please. And I do have a couple questions for you all. One question that I have is, at what point does the neglect of the Forest Town Ditch become an enormous liability for South Feather?
Becomes an enormous liability when we believe that there is significant risk to being able to deliver or up to 11 cubic feet per second at the WD6 station.
And is there any way, is there any avenue through the current 2005 contract for South Feather to mitigate for these issues if North Yuba does not want to come to the table and does not want to accept any offers of help? Is there any avenue for South Feather to essentially force the North Yuba to take the offer?
That's an insightful and fair question. I need to continue to study not only the language in the agreements, but the spirit of that agreement to really effectively answer that. I know that's not the answer you're looking for. I'm really not prepared to answer that at this moment.
Okay, and the last comment that I just wanted to make is that this is a vitally important offer that you have made, and the entire community is grateful for the offer, and we're also grateful to be shown how a competent general manager and a competent water district takes care of their facilities. And one of the things that I think is often overlooked, we talk about the irrigation system constantly, and we talk about the irrigation customers a lot, but this is also an issue that is going to affect the domestic customers as well. And it affected them last year, because they were not able to actually provide any kind of fire protection for their home because of the antiquated and neglected domestic system that also runs off of this ditch. So on behalf of the entire community, I want to thank you so very much for your amazing offer and the amazing education you've just given us all.
Thank you.
One more.
One
more
day again. Ms. Renee? Do you have another initial question?
Ms. Renee, you're muted.
That better?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe we can show our community's engagement and level of gratefulness. I'm telling you that in 1 week, we got 200 people to sign a petition to ask North Yuba to please take your prices on board. So we have 200 people already on the record with a signature from our community. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other additional public comments?
I have nothing in the email as of 2:32.
None here.
Thank you. So, Board, if I could direct you back to the cover sheet. You've heard Council Cooper, myself, speak on behalf of South Feather. You've heard public comment today. We're seeking to ratify, a motion to ratify.
So if I can just jump in here and add to the recommended form of action that is printed in your agenda packet. And I would recommend adding read, I move to ratify the South Feather Water and Power Agency, North Yuba Water District Mutual Aid Cooperation and Water Supply Agreement as executed in 1996, amended in 2003, and amended in 2006, and to ratify the offer made by Agency Council on May 7, 2021.
So I'll make a motion. I move to ratify the South Feather Water and Power Agency, New York Water District Mutual Aid Cooperation and Water Supply Agreement as executed in 1996, amended in 2003, and amended in 2006, and to ratify the council letter and recommendation for maintenance in the May, as noted in the May 7, 2021 letter from council.
I'll second.
First and second. I'm assuming it's fair to say we just did our public questions?
Yes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Five ayes, no nays.
What do you think North Yuba is going to say about this?
That's speculatory, and I would hope they would see value in this offer, as Council Cooper suggested, and everyone benefits. So, but
they haven't been very positive with anything so far.
Well, let's hope this is the beginning.
Good.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I mean, who doesn't love a fabulous offer thrown in your lap for an incredible price? What's not to love about this?
Thank you, Lord. So then we would move on to approval of checks and warrants and continue from there. Thank you.
All right, Steve?
Nice.
Good afternoon, board members. We are back to tab two, and we have a number of items just to bring to your attention and highlight for you. a number of checks, payments made in the this list of warrants or checks, which are for April, were applied to project code number 2021-0975. That was that's a project for improving our SCADA operations and moving them over to our Sunset Communication site. And we're doing that essentially Forest County local labor, so that's why you're seeing a number of different purchases made against that account. And then we also have a number of charges in, again, back in April that went to Project 2020-200. That was our irrigation, new irrigation line on the Oro Bangor Highway area, getting up to the Red Hawk Ranch, what we had previously called Red Hawk Ranch activities. In this month's listing of checks, page one, check number 59883 was a payment to the state for fees for the dams. That's based on the heights and the number of dams that we got. It's actually down a little bit this year. Previous years were was a $286,000 obligation, $242,000 this year. Let's see. I should mention page one. There are three entries actually there. 59882, 59898. 59906, and then one more entry on the next page, page two. Those were four different checks that we issued and prepared and issued for our water transfer petitions going to various state agencies. We actually put those on hold, and you'll hear more about that later today, this afternoon, I'm sure. But we prepared those checks, and then, as I said, we had, at this point, had not taken necessary actions, and so those are those will be voided, and new checks have been issued subsequently this month. So that's just for your information on that.
Is that a typo on page one, Steve? Typo on 59902,
ACOM? We will make a comment, I don't know, straight through. Interested. One of them, would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. No, it's not a typo. I'm sure, you know, as you know, it's been a while since you've seen that.
This is a very past due invoice that we had been working on during last year to vet out that process. And what this ties to is the final construction report and submission to both the FERC and DSOD. And we're still waiting for final submission and approval from those governing entities. So this is not incorrect. So these were monies due for that work to be able to get to the final construction report. And there will still be at least one more invoice, assuming FERC and DSOD accept what's submitted to them as well. So we're not quite out of the woods yet with the final sign-off by the governing authorities on that Lost Creek Dam construction project.
So there could be another check to
AECOM? There will be, because it's highly unlikely we will be able to submit and not have to go through a review and response process with either DSOD or FERC.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did look at that, obviously, very closely, that whole invoice, and made a number of phone calls in the meantime as well. Near the bottom of page one, just an information item, check 59912 to Northern Safety. There's a new code that I don't think I've mentioned before, the Department Code 52103. We've created, these are not new dollars, but we've created this code just to manage and keep a solid accounting for employee clothing and allowances. Outerwear that the agency has been purchasing, and again you'll see that show up again, that account show up a couple more times in this list of checks. Let me comment on page two, check number 59919. That was up near the top. We have a fairly high expense there to a local locksmithing company. We brought a whole new set of padlocks for various irrigation ditches, the fences on the irrigation ditches, and so that's the explanation behind that that expense. Near the bottom, page 259950 was a payment to VistaNet, and that was a $4,792 expense. I've asked Art to give us some background on that one, on that payment.
Approximately two-thirds of that are monthly recurring expenses for services rendered, such as spam filtering or internet connections, licenses, fees, things like that. The remaining 1,700 are for services rendered and assistance in new hardware, reconfiguration of backup servers, things like that.
Thank you, Art. I'm moving over to page four, near the bottom, 60031 is a check to electrical maintenance consultants. It's a larger amount. Just to highlight it, that is a budgeted item, but it was just, it's a repair item, and so it's included in our operating budget. But Dan, did I ask you to elaborate on that at all or not?
I think you sure I can. So yes, this is a budgeted item, the Forestown hydro generator, stator winding. It has some problems with its insulation of the copper winding, so we have the insulation repaired, assessed and repaired to mitigate the insulation problems and to hopefully extend the life of the winding.
Very good. Thank you. And then on page 506, right in the middle there, 60047 was a payment to Sierra Circuit Breakers. And that was for a circuit breaker out of Kelly Powerhouse. Comment on that one as well.
So, yes, so the powerhouses have a backup power source called the station service. And the circuit breakers that are in this equipment are becoming obsolete, so we this was a purchase to have a spare part to allow a hot swap into. There's two breakers per powerhouse, and so a total of 8 of these breakers, and we have 2 spares that can work at all locations. So just having a spare valve just to plug it in, plug in a spare, and then hopefully get the bad unit repaired.
Thank you. And then just going back to page 4, we have a couple checks, payments to HDR Engineering. And Ray, did I ask you on 59998?
You did. So 5998 for $293.91 was a final review of project status, and then those efforts were placed on hold. So HDR, as you know, we've been working with them historically for this agency has for a number of years on the impending new FERC license. With Crystal and Cultural regulatory compliance, we were able to shift some level of that effort internally. So this was just a final cleanup right now, and we will call upon HDR as needed for tasks that are outside our capabilities or skill sets within the agency.
Those are the payments that I just wanted to highlight this month, but be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Expenditures for the month of April of 2021, an amount of $1,551,956.08, and authorize a transfer of $1.8 million from the TCB General Fund to the TCB Accounts Payable and Payroll Fund for the payment of regular operating expenses.
I'll second that motion.
Second. Any comments?
None here.
Nothing in the email as of 2:45.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. 5 ayes. Thank you, Steve. All right. Go into tab 3. Still you, see it looks like.
Very good. Thank you for that approval of the checks and warrants. Appreciate that. Last month, the State Controller's Governmental Pay Report on Governmental Compensation in California for South Feather Water Power Agency was completed and submitted. I think we submitted that on exactly the day of the board meeting, our last board meeting. So that was submitted in a timely manner, and will be included in the State Controller's Report, which is available on its website. Comment on some activity that we had last month, a review of our investments, and then also our investment policy is presented with this month's meeting. Finance Committee of Directors Wilburn and Hickman met in a workshop setting last month, and we reviewed our cash practices as well as the investment policy itself. The policy continues to mirror the government code that sets forth opportunities and restrictions available to local government governments in California. We've worked through our practices and looked at our schedule of usual investments. Heard some advice and some comments from the Finance Committee, and we'll work to implement those as cash becomes available and opportunities arise. We'll continue to look into those things. We're trying thinking through different options for increasing investment returns, but at the same time, we have an obligation to make sure our funds stay safe and are liquid and available when we need them. Directors, Hickman or Wilburn, any comments would you like to add to that?
So I appreciate the presentation that you did for us. It was good to learn about more of the information and look forward to seeing what we can do moving forward.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, I would second that as well.
Very good. And we'll continue to work through again. I mean, it shows up every month, so we'll keep working to do what we can. Okay, continuing to work on our audit related tasks. And then we have a new Dropbox for payments and trying to make it as accessible, as simple as we can for folks to make payments. An opportunity. These are hard. These are payments which would come to us in the form of the envelopes. Possible now for somebody just to drive through and drop it off in the box.
That is a very nice thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you to Ray, to the rest of the team. Ricky Lease actually developed it or fabricated it. So we're fortunate to have that expertise in the system. And we cleaned up the landscaping around it too as well. So. Now for a difficult part of the conversation, or at least my presentation, I've got a number of typical graphs and schedules attached. Let me run through those and give you an update as to where we are with our financial picture. Page number one is just the graph showing our power generation revenues. These are for the four powerhouses. January, February, March, and April have been received. And April's payment was received this morning. Comes in on the 25th of each month. So in spite of it being a low number, very low number, it's a good day for me, 25th of each month, when we see that payment show up in our bank account. But you can see 2021 is the red bar. January through April here, each of those 4 months have been less than average, in some cases significantly less. So that's kind of where we've been. At the outlook for May, per Dan's informal report at this point, is also carrying along on the same trend. So that's an issue that we are well aware of at the staff level. And we'll be talking about that again later as the meeting goes on. Next page shows our cumulative power generation revenues so far, 2021. We have now, as of April, basically are hitting the low point in our most recent years that we've got reported there. And May, again, will bring us, so it'll be very clear that 2021 will at this point show not a favorable revenue stream. Providing you with numbers, this normal financial reports available. See our actual experience reported to you in these reports on pages 3 through 10 or so. Are through April 30th, which would be 4 months out of the 12-month year. So percentage-wise, that would put us at a 33%, is what the calendar would tell us. So on page 3, top line, sale of electricity in the JFOP, Joint Facilities Operating Fund, you can see as in terms of matching up against budget, we're at 19%, so not what we'd like to see. Our operating expenses in total for power division, joint facilities operating fund, again, you can see on the right-hand side there, we're at 32%, so we're tracking fine on operating budget for operating expenses versus budget. But of course, as mentioned, the revenue just isn't keeping pace. Same story on the general fund side. I don't need to belabor it. That's just where we're at. and then my final attachments are it's the investment policy again. for your information and also for your acceptance as well.
Operational updates, water treatment operations. You can see that our Miners Ranch treatment plant production was up to 155 million gallons. So you can see on the trended bar as the season starts to warm up, of course, that's going to increase. Our average was still only about 5 million gallons per day, so we're looking forward to driving that up a little bit better, a little bit higher. The 2021 irrigation season, so all water flows are delivering as planned. The ditch tenders are operating respective conveyance systems at peak performance so far early in the system, so we're very pleased on how the year's going, at least in the early part. When you go to page 2, you'll see the CFS by locations, the Upper Forbes Town Ditch, Lower Forbes Town, Bangor Canal, and Palermo. And so you can get a feel for what we're doing there and we're delivering from the system. But right now, all active irrigation accounts within South Feather are being fed water and on rotation systems in those areas that are necessary. In terms of water operations, the crews have been really busy over the last month across the district. Again, you can see, just kind of get a feel for the types of things we've done, whether it's new services, vegetation management. We did have some regulator vaults. We've had some spikes, which I'll kind of go back to here in a moment on regulator vaults and some of the things that can be contributing to that and those issues. And we did have a couple leaks to address as well. So let's discuss fire hydrants. We've talked about this over the previous months. I'll jump right to the picture on page 3 first and then go from there. So. This particular fire hydrant was the Highway 162 Old Olive Highway. If you recall, we worked with the county and relocated that hydrant since our last board meeting. So it's actually moved about 400 feet down the road to a better location. The reason for that is the amount of traffic from a safety standpoint, the water flow coming out of that hydrant as it was being connected and disconnected by water trucks. It's actually breaching the pavement and traveling across the road, had nowhere for that water to go. Mm-hmm. So it's since been relocated down the road and the natural runoff goes into a culvert, etc. The reason I included this picture was compliments of the storage unit owner across the street. This is a snapshot of just one typical morning. So one morning, this is a drone video of 7 water trucks lined up to use that hydrant. And so there's a number of issues with that around construction meters, hydrant use, their intended purpose, et cetera. But clearly, the water trucks and the hydrants are being used for commercial enterprise, and that's not the intent or the reason for hydrants. In addition, if you are not properly trained on how to operate a hydrant, you can do what's called water hammering to your system. So there are real possibilities that hydrant use throughout the district is creating water hammering, which is exposing leaks in infrastructure and providing challenges at regulator vaults to manage that. And so, we will continue to work with you as a board. Currently, we have 24 at this point, construction meters. All of those construction meters are issued out. Only 25% of those have been returning readings so that we can count for that water. Here in a few moments, you're going to hear from Kristen McCullough on our urban water management plan, water shortage contingency, et cetera, and I'm sure she will emphasize the importance of knowing where our water is going. And so construction meters are a challenge at best, mm-hmm. and something we want to continue to manage out, quite honestly, other than short-term work, et cetera. So we're hoping as we move forward in the future, you would ask good questions and see and understand why the district needs to minimize the use of these fire hydrants other than for emergency purposes.
What do these meters cost? And so did we get a deposit?
We do. So about $950 approximately, and that's the deposit that we require. So basically the meter's covered from that standpoint. But once that meter leaves our eyesight, trying to track down those meters and get readings and receive payments and all of that is a significant challenge. But we do get a deposit for the cost of the meter. We've had a number of people asking for the district to procure additional construction meters, but it just amplifies the problem. So construction meter is just as it's described, right? And within our rules and regulations, it's used for a short-term construction project. It's issued out to you. You turn in your meter read. We capture that water usage. We charge you for that consumption. You return the meter and you move on. They're not intended to leave our eyesight. Then we have to chase you all over the district to find you.
Mm-hmm. And we have no way of capturing that money unless we physically get a hold of the meter.
That's exactly right, because we need the meter read.
And they don't even necessarily need to hook up that meter to pull water, right?
That's
so
right.
They may not even be running our water through our meter so we can bill them.
Exactly.
Seems like that whole system is somewhat antiquated, not in our favor.
It is. You know, from a budgetary standpoint or potential grant funding, we're looking at, you know, one option, because really it's unaccounted for water. That, you know, obviously we have an economic situation, but really we have a bigger situation, and that's, you know, knowing where our water goes and protecting our water rights, etc. We can install hydrant meters, right? So underground meters, so we can actually read those consumptions that people are taking draws off those systems. So that solves consumption if we can afford to put meters on there. What it doesn't solve is revenue, right? You still lose the revenue. Because we have, and we do this, the whole district is trained to communicate with those. When we roll up and see someone drawing off a hydrant that does not have a meter, we address that with them. We send them here to the Orville headquarters for bulk water refills, those types of things. But there's two factors at play, right?
Seems like the only way to manage that would be to have distinct billing stations.
Exactly.
With an onboard meter and a card reader that's directly linked to a credit card, so we could pay it immediately, right?
Yep, and that's exactly.
And no draws from an emergency fire hydrant system.
Yep, the very insightful. That's exactly what we're thinking too. We're just going to have to manage that accordingly. You know, we're eyeing our property next door at a future point where that's exactly what that is, right? It's a card read bulk fill station that handles and addresses that situation. That still doesn't prevent people using hydrants when it's out of sight from the district. So that may mean cooperation with CAL FIRE around, you know, hydrant locks, caps, those types of things for those hydrants. But bulk filling stations with card readers is really the future.
Well, theft would go away once it was known that nobody should be hooking up to a hydrant but an authorized agency vehicle or a fire vehicle, right?
You would eventually end
that.
You would hope so over time, but it'll still require some level of community communication.
Okay. The big problem you got, Rafe, is when these guys hook their meters up, and if they're not training these water truck drivers how to do it properly, they can blow the seals right out of your fire hydrant, and that's a pretty big problem.
That's exactly right. And the concern is, because we have so many hydrants within the district, being able, from a resource standpoint, to continually test those and keep going around and around robin and test those hydrants for when there is a fire and it's a real need. The last thing we need, and Director Starr had mentioned this a couple times in the past about, you know, heaven forbid, emergency services roll up and there's a problem with that hydrant, that location.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's my comment on hydrants today. Public relations, I thought it was important to share with you today that we've started receiving a fair amount of public inquiry around water availability, status of South Feather. There's a little bit of confusion and misunderstanding. Part of that is there's kind of been a turnover of newer folks coming into our district through property sales, etc., that assume that South Feather draws our water supply directly out of Lake Oroville. So we've been addressing that. We're continuing to communicate and manage through that. But I wanted you all to be aware of that and, you know, our strategy on making sure folks understand our water conveyance system, etc. With that said, though, the Slide Creek Campground will indeed be closed this season. And am I correct? So standing here right now, that is firm.
Likely through 2023.
Through 2023. And I captured, I did a snip of the U.S. Forest Service commentary, which Kristen just referred to. They're saying it'll be closed until March of 2023. That is not due to drought conditions. That is due to the wildfire we experienced last year. So I wanted you to be aware of that if anyone asks you why Slide Creek Campground is closed. Not due to drought, a little different than Lake Oroville, due to the fire situation last year, potential hazards around that campground.
That's a good idea.
Okay. And then continuing on to page four, the Highway 162 road widening project. Again, this is from Arbel Avenue, heading east up towards Gold Country Casino. So if you've traveled up and down that road, you'll see that Pacific Gas and Electric has been performing their work up there on gas line reloads, etc. Our turn is coming, so we will do a formal internal project kickoff actually next week to start our procurement, our inventory and procurement of materials and building our execution plan for our work. We will start on August 2nd, and then we have until September 13th to do our work. We expect our time on the job to be 13 to 14 days in total. This work will be done at night. Because of the traffic hazards in that area, we will be sourcing traffic control. So we'll use, you know, lighted signage, traffic control, pilot cars, etc. to perform our work. You can see the three categories that our work will be broken down into to accomplish our area of responsibility on that project. We're also now involved in the weekly project meetings with Caltrans, PG&E, etc. And then there will be a handoff June 18th between South Feather and PG&E. So as PG&E demobilizes, we will pick up, we'll make sure we've performed all of our locates, etc., so we know exactly where their infrastructure is and the new infrastructure in relation to what work we will be doing starting in August. Questions or comments on that project? That one's significant. It's significant just primarily due to the traffic situation in that area. Power purchase agreement. So we are expecting to receive power purchase proposal from PG&E in the upcoming weeks. Dan Leon and I actually had a meeting yesterday, so we learned a fair amount around PG&E's new view and vision in 2021 and beyond around what they are or are not able to do in terms of offering power purchase agreements, what those look like. So we'll be sharing more of that content here shortly. And then we actually do have a draft proposal from NCPA, Northern California Power Agency, that is in review. And we expect to present the NCPA offer and PG&E's offer at our June 22nd meeting for commentary, questions, etc. We'll not be seeking to adopt approval. It'll be to get those in front of you. We'll talk about the pros and cons and continue that discussion. But we will need to be making a decision here as we go into the summer months on what our future power purchase arrangements look like for the hydro project. To give you a little bit of information to read, I won't go through all of it now, but you know, what does the current energy market look like? So I put a fair amount of commentary in here that was published by energysage.com, and it's really about the new theme today, and that was really confirmed at yesterday's PG&E meeting with Dan and I, you know, is around REC credits, not so much energy delivery on the grid, those types of things. So the shift in the market for hydro energy and the value of South Feather's assets has changed since the original 10-year power purchase agreement with PG&E. Does not mean that we will not be able to maximize opportunities. It just not be the way in which it was done 10 years ago. So I'll let you read through that at any point. If you have any questions, you can come back and ask me about that. That's what I have this afternoon. Any questions or comments from the updates?
So payment for these credits. You just educate me about this a little more. Is that directly tied to how many kilowatts of power you use? Or is that above and beyond the cost of your power you're buying this credit?
So there's two. There's renewable energy credits, and then there's resource adequacy payments. So one's fixed based on the nameplate value. And Dan could probably do a better job explaining. Would you like to explain that to them?
Yeah, sure. So the renewable energy credits, the RECs that I referred to here, they're a product that are in place that allows a power agency to purchase credits in case they are producing, say, an excessive amount of fossil fuel is in their fleet of generation,
and the state or the PUC or the government entities require the load serving or the generation, the company providing the energy, requires them to have a percentage of green power. And the green power could be, you know, solar, photovoltaic, wind. If they don't possess that, then an entity such as South South Feather that has 23 megawatts of capacity between Kelly Ridge Powerhouse and Salt Powerhouse, as these powerhouses generate and produce on the onto the grid, they are putting green power onto the electric grid. So then another company can, once that energy has been generated by a green resource, then another entity that lacks green energy can satisfy the mandate to provide such by purchasing those green credits from South Feather, or in our case, South Feather. So depending on the volume of energy that we produce for Kelly Powerhouse and Slide Powerhouse, we can sell that. In the current contract, it is a fixed, a locked-in amount that we provide.
And who's controlling this credit? How is this credit controlled, like monetarily wise? So we say we produce this 20 megawatts of power, we throw it out there on the grid, PG&E gives us the 31 cents a megawatt hour. Okay, now how does this credit get created? Obviously this is a scheme, you know, a card shuffle to make this happen, but how does that start?
So based on our relationship with PG&E, so we're a seller, they're the buyer, they pay us a flat fee every month for those two powerhouses.
Which is the same as they're paying us for all of our power, right?
They're paying a flat fee that's not based on volume for those two powerhouses, but we're being paid for the powerhouses being available. So as long as we'll see in my report later here, as long as we maintain Kelly and Slide to be available and to be dispatchable, runnable by PG&E, they pay us a fixed flat fee. Now, PG&E in turn can sell that as per our contract. They can sell to somebody else or be a reseller, so to speak. We have no control of that.
So PG&E gets these credits. PG&E makes up these credits, and it's based on potential capacity, not actually what they bought from us.
Well, PG&E buys a number of credits from us based on how much we produce. So if Kelly, say, last month produced 1,000 megawatt hours and Slide produced 1,000 megawatt hours, then there's 2,000 megawatt hours of RECs that PG&E gets. And PG&E in turn pays us a flat fee. And that flat fee really isn't based on how much energy we produce, based on the contract. That said, those RECs do have a market value. And the kind of contract we have, we're just getting a flat fee payment for those.
Okay.
So we know every month we're going to get so much money.
We're going to get a fixed, correct. As long as powerhouses are available and operable, which they are, then we receive a fixed payment as per the current contract with PG&E. That's correct.
And then the other power plants we can negotiate with whoever else we want.
In the case of other potential buyers in the future, those renewable energy credits can be we can sell those as a fixed flat fee, or those can be sold on the amount or volume of energy that Kelly and Slide produce. It just depends on the contract. So, for example, you know, the NCPA offer, you know, would have its terms and conditions that Ray will discuss, you know, next month.
Okay, so Dan closed me out on this concept.
Sure.
Okay, so now PG&E now possesses these credits that they just, so they print some credits up on paper or electronically, and they're just sitting there. They're not really real anything, right? They're just credit.
It's electronic certificate. Yeah.
And now somebody buys that from PG&E?
Well,
So say it's a big company, you're a big company producing whatever, and you're burning fossil fuels. Okay, so now I want to buy some credits from PG&E. They buy these credits independent of power they're buying?
If PG&E possesses the credits, they can resell them. Or, actually, I take that back. Based on what I've read about the credits, they can only be sold once. So once, I forgot that detail. So they can only be, thank you. Those, once we provide the credits to PG&E, that satisfies if PG&E needs green credits to satisfy a certain portfolio or a certain percentage of green credits, the transfer of our volume of energy from Sly and Kelly in the form of green credits satisfies that requirement. But the transaction, once and I transfer, I can transfer the, or PG&E can transfer the RECs from South Feather to PG&E. Once that happens, like you said, it's electronic, it's kind of virtual. Once that transaction happens, it happens once, and those credits can no longer be transferred again.
So PG&E is utilizing all those credits for their purposes. They're not selling them to somebody that buys power from them.
The credits basically are transferred once.
Okay.
And we don't know what kind of reselling PG&E might be doing.
Okay, so they're able to certify that they're selling somebody green power because they have those credits, even though they're not actually transferring those credits to that energy buyer.
They're satisfying their portion of green energy that they must provide based on the state or federal laws to provide a certain percentage of green energy. They can either have wind turbines and it's photovoltaic or hydro, or they can have these credits to satisfy the requirement.
Okay, I think I get it.
Yeah. It's difficult for me to understand.
You can continue.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes. Well, of course. Thank you. So, good afternoon. And the next few minutes here, directors, I'd like to share with you aspects of our April 2021 monthly report here for Power Division. And to continue on the theme that Steve had mentioned, the theme here is dry water conditions, dry hydrological conditions. State Water Resource Control Board has classified the current water year as critical, which is more severe than dry. The DWR, Department of Water Resources, observed conditions have us at about 48% of average for water storage in Northern California. The snow storage, snowpack, was at 4% of average for April 1. It's dropped to 2%, so the snow is basically gone. We have our storage in our two reservoirs, Little Grass Valley and Sly, at 105,000 acre feet. And this is holding. Actually, it's increasing slightly, ever so slightly, because the last bit of snow and a little bit of inflow is coming in. And so, basically, right now, as look at this table here at the bottom of the first page, you'll see here that that the scale here goes as high as 25% on the left. And what we see here is that we produce, basically, in April, 3% of the total capacity that we have in our units, 3%. We produce 2,300 megawatt hours, and we have the capacity to produce nearly 90,000. And why, you may ask? Well, it's the low water conditions. Our storage and reservoirs is low, lower than it's been in the past. But I want to mention that, our current contract with PG&E that we have, there are storage minimum values for each month of the year. So, for example, in May, the minimum storage value is 135,000 acre feet, and our storage is currently 105,000, so we're below that. So, as we go to the next few months here, May, June, and July, the minimum drops of 135,000 acre feet to 130, to 110, to 95. So at some point, our storage gets above that minimum and we'll start running once again. So in talking with PG&E's dispatchers and looking at their hydro models that they provided for us, they state that they will begin to run as resume running us in July. So again, we have some model information that Wraith and I have reviewed as we talk with PG&E. On to the next page. Speaking of availability, the top of the page there, where it says the third column, available for generation hours, were 720 hours last month in April. And as you can see, we had we had 720 hours available nearly for all four units. Kelly only had 2 hours short. So our crew, our O&M crew, is doing their job as far as safety and their skill to keep the units available to run, but we have basically a low water condition, unfortunately, and the way the contract is currently written. And again, so if you look at the second column from the right, additional gen not dispatched at full output, we can see we didn't run hardly at all at full output. We didn't run at all at full output, so it's unfortunate. Pricing. We're in the mid-30s. ISO's pricing is mid-30s, and the average has been high 20s, so your pricing is good. As far as maintenance, the next heading there, powerhouses, they're all fully operational. They're fully available. We did replace a sump pump at Fort Sound Powerhouse. Under other maintenance, so we did our crew did, Water Division and Power Division crew did the final snow survey here for the 21 water year. And this data gets input to the state. So for the overall reporting, crew continue to do the preventive maintenance, inspections and cleanings of thrash racks and canals, remove problem trees and clear vegetation and so forth. We also had some new controls installed at Slate Creek Tunnel to operate the actuators at Slate Creek Tunnel remotely. PG&E completed their line outages that they had scheduled for, which were actually here this month. So those were completed. And I have a couple more headings here to talk with here, to talk about here, but I wanted to point out to here on the regulatory compliance, the heading of statewide drought update, and I'd like to ask Kristen if she could expand on this section here, then I'll resume the rest of the report. So thank you, Kristen, I appreciate it.
Hello. We just wanted to start providing a routine update on hydrologic conditions. Obviously, the droughts, the governor's drought declaration, the beginning of this month, as previously noted, has customers concerned and in general folks throughout Butte County. We are in the position to be surface water dependent, which puts us in a better position than some of our groundwater dependent neighbors, and so for that we're all thankful, but because we are in California and regulations continue to increase, we, as you will see with the urban water management plan presentation, the new requirement for a water shortage contingency plan, and that is, you will I'll explain further, but it's a component of the urban water management plan, but it's also a requirement to adopt as a standalone document. And so that in companion with the drought declaration and the Butte County drought task force convened last week as well, I think it's just prudent for us to continue to monitor and update the board on hydrologic conditions. So I don't know if you have any questions about anything, but the intent is that we will continue to kind of do an enhanced update on those conditions as a requirement of this water shortage contingency plan and just to be prudent during the drought declaration.
Thank you.
Hello again. Steve, we'll go over the last few final tabs on the headings here. Under projects, Ray talked about power purchase agreements here. And we have other projects involved in this effort, this transition effort, or what we call the energy delivery transition projects. So we continue to replace electrical and communication equipment throughout the agency. As we prepare here for this, we have meter replacements taking place. So SS-17, one of our monitoring downstream areas here, downstream of the Fort Sound Diversion Reservoir, which did sustain fire damage. So our agency crew have begun fabrication and installation of the safety platforms, ladders, and other walkways that were damaged or destroyed during the fires. And then at Lost Creek Dam, mid-level valve access, crews are similarly fabricating steel platforms, ladders, and stairs for access to these mid-level outlet valves. And so again, the structures here are to provide safe access to the equipment for operations and periodic maintenance. And there's no update on personnel. And again, the three bases that follow, of course, the one that I talked about last month, which is the precip one here. And we can see the year 21 water year here. And this is just one data point. Of course, this is not comprehensive as far as all of the data that we have available. But this is the rain gauge that we have at Strawberry, which has been a very good comparison tool to show the relative amount of dryness here year to year. So 21 here for the year 21, we're actually at about 21 inches of precipitation on that gauge. And we've been as high as, you know, 140 or above during the 17 water year. You know, so it's just, it's, you can draw an average line through all of these, but it's, you know, the variance in the data points is great. The next page here showing the two reservoirs, you can see the red plot lines as they proceed from left to right. This is showing the storage of Sly and the Grass Valley reservoirs. And yes, we are, you know, on a bit low here on that storage, so which is why we aren't running the units. So that's all the content that I have here. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dan.
Can I just add something?
Yes, of course.
This was mentioned earlier, but in Steve's report about the transfer petitions being submitted, I just want to go on record here that the agency's proposed transfer, there is sufficient water to cover all of North Yuba's needs, all of this agency's needs, satisfy all the regulatory requirements we have, generate power, and then there's a little bit extra to sell to a potential buyer that is in a pretty dire situation. So this is not, while the graphs indicate lower storage than a normal year, this is not a situation where the transfer is shorting anybody else. I just want to be clear on that.
Thanks, Dustin. I appreciate you putting that out there. All right, so that looks like we're done with staff reports. Let's go into tab 5, surplus equipment.
So earlier this month, staff collectively worked with both division fleet managers, the division foreman, Steve as the finance manager, Dan as power division manager, and then took a proposed list to Wraith that now you have before you for surplus activity or a request to do so. The evaluation process included emission standards, safety standards, operational sustainability, future budgeting, and the cost of repair versus market value. So wanted to make sure that those categories were put in front of you so there was a clear understanding of how this list would have been composed. What we've done is also break it out where the assets are assigned between water and power divisions collectively. And the issues and reasons why we would look to get these off of the books. I believe the last time this activity would have taken place in terms of bringing you a list would have been October of 2018. I think it was maybe one or two. So we've gone virtually 2 years of not having anything, if this list seems a little bit large to you guys. While I'll tell you, we're constantly evaluating in all fairness for both the future budgeting aspect. Obviously, emissions are due on an annual basis for reporting, and that's through multiple channels and multiple programs through the California Air Resources Control Board.
So how are these going to be replaced?
So in one particular case, the T-139 Ford Ranger truck, that was a meter reader truck and has actually already been replaced with one of the newer Toyota Tacomas that had been budgeted and had been purchased in 2020's capital improvement plan process. So in some cases, we look to rent equipment versus buying. So when you look at a 1975 T-111 GMC with 99,000 miles on it, that thing actually had its last day in early 2020, I believe. So we've had that thing for that long, but in terms of usage, we need to do a clear understanding of rental versus buying and what the overall operational performance, what do we really expect to get out from these vehicles moving forward.
So what is, have we replaced that?
No.
And we're going to replace that or we're going to rent?
thing that.
For 2021, we will rent on, as we look at our outer years for projects, depending on the amount of need for flatbed truck, and ultimately be seeking to replace it, but near term rent.
The thing's a classic. I always like seeing it out there on the truck. That's a shame.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like the demo.
Yeah. And good luck with the motor.
So what about like the chipper and the snowblower?
So the chipper is a 1985, so that's going to be both from a safety perspective. Obviously, ordinance and standards have come a long way from both a safety perspective and then from an environmental standpoint, significant issues with keeping that registered in the portable equipment reporting process through the California Air Resources Control Board. And actually that particular item has sat idle for quite some time. So
that's an example
where
it would be replaced, right?
Right, so that was one that we would consider eligible to be replaced and no rental involved at that point. In fact, we recently submitted for a new wood chipper in the CAL FIRE fuel reduction. So hopefully, hoping to report back good news on that process in the coming months.
So I'll make a motion.
Okay.
I move approval of declared listed assets as surplus and having them either recycled or sold in addition to being removed from the agency's asset list.
A first.
Second.
A second. Thank you. Any comments, Art?
None. Yeah, comment on that chipper. 3,132 hours. That thing is wore out, man. That takes a lot of work to keep it going.
Yeah.
No comments on the lab or by email.
Thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Bye, guys.
Thank you. I don't know if everybody's dreading because I've got the thickest tag this month.
That's pretty impressive, thickest tag.
This month we're coming to you with a couple of reports that are required by California Water Code. The, as I mentioned, the Water Shortage Contingency Plan. The second report in your tab is a new item that is required under California Water Code. Since your 2015 presentation on your Urban Water Management Plan, there have been significant updates to Water Code just because water conditions for that 2014 through 2016 drought period started moving legislation. And so here we are today with additional regulatory requirements. And I do want to point out that it is required for agencies that have the more than 3,000 service connections to submit these urban water management plans to the state in order to be eligible for any type of state grant funds or loans. So the hope though is that with this document that we can make it user-friendly enough that it's something that staff can utilize as a resource, that you as board members can utilize as a resource, that the information is concise and clear enough that we can use it in that way. In addition to checking the box for the state. So some of the new elements that are required are in Chapter 1, there's an enhanced lay description. This was meant to be kind of a takeaway for bringing new staff on board and explaining what the agency looks like. It'll be a component that we refer to the current consultants working on the Municipal Services Review for LAFCO. Their update, they will utilize this document heavily for information about our agency. The requirement to do some data analysis on both single year dry years versus 5 year dry years. So we're looking at our supply based on historical watershed yield and then our typical annual demand, and then a single dry year demand, and then a 5 year dry year demand to look and make documentation to the state on whether or not we're looking at a surplus or a shortage situation. And again, just want to point out that our watershed is significant enough to cover all of our needs for hydro generation as well as domestic and irrigation supply.
There's a seismic risk analysis that is required this year that is covered under both previous documents that were prepared for treatment plant emergency response plan requirements, as well as analysis for dam safety. And then lastly, our Butte County local hazard mitigation plan. One, our annex to that local plan included some seismic analysis as well as the overall countywide seismic component. So each of those are referenced in the document. We are required to bring the plans, the urban water management plan and the water shortage contingency plan, to this board for adoption and then submittal to the state on July 1st. We intended to get this to you for a 30-day review period, as well as posting things to the board's website, as well as making it available by hard copy for any member of the public that would request such a copy. We would like to take input from our community planning agencies and the public at large and this board, should you have any comments on the report. And then at our next board meeting, we will hopefully have been able to address and incorporate any of those comments, concerns, and in addition, you know, following some of the other requirements with further public noticing in the newspaper. With regard to the water shortage contingency plan, this is a new component of the urban water management plan, but it is also a requirement by Water Code to adopt that as a separate standalone document, with the intention that any board and agency would update that plan annually or on an as-needed basis without having to wait for that next five-year period to update that plan. So because that is a requirement, and we will be expected for our 2025 urban water management plan to provide data associated with the parameters outlined in that water shortage contingency plan, it will be a more routine item for this board to be updated on hydrologic conditions and how they impact the agency. Additionally, just tying in the agency participation by way of Director Woolburn and myself for the Wyandotte Creek GSA effort and the SGMA requirements. Those are noted in both of those plans as well. Another additional reference that is required is the emergency response planning document that I previously mentioned. There are a couple of different locations that we reference that document. As a sidebar, we have the policy committee will be convened to review those documents. In 2018, the America's Water Infrastructure Act was passed, requiring both these emergency response planning documents as well as a risk and resiliency assessment be completed and certified by an agency, and then those certifications have to be submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency. So the effort has been put in by staff to complete both of those documents. Our emergency response plan follows the template that was provided by the EPA, but what the committee will be asked to review is just that template that is a summary of reference of the actual emergency response plan that is not a document that's available to the public. For Miners Ranch treatment plan, it's quite extensive. If I didn't clarify inherently that the Infrastructure Act is specific to domestic systems, treatment and distribution systems. So at the June meeting, you will also be asked to adopt both of those plans so that they can be submitted according to their requirements to the EPA. They have to be certified in both one in June and one in December. But because of the adoption by reference in the urban water management plan, we went ahead and did a parallel effort to get those plans done and before you to adopt at the same meeting. I think that I've run through just about all the high points. So if any of you have any questions about document content or impacts to the agency for what the reporting means, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I we're sitting here and realizing that I neglected to include any contact information, so that is an adjustment I should probably make for the website version, is a contact email for anybody that does have comments about the plan.
I was going to elaborate on that. So Director Starr, Director Edwards, you two are the 2021 Policy and Contracts Committee. So because we are now going into the public hearing period, if we receive comments throughout the month, I will inform the two of you prior to June's board meeting so that then we can openly discuss with all five directors.
Okay. Right. Do you want to meet sometime in the three-year score?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Do you want to meet sometime during that period in the three-year score?
I think we can base that on the number of comments we receive or not. Okay, we'll coordinate it. We'll do that accordingly.
We are required to post notice in local newspapers on June 1st for a 7-day window, again on June 14th for a 7-day window. So that may garner a little bit more public interest. Right at this point in time, the notifications have been sent out as required to the local planning agencies as well as the schools that we serve as a courtesy.
Any questions for Kristen?
Thank you, Krista. That's a lot of work.
I have questions.
Okay, Justin.
Kristen, I'm sorry if you may have covered this already, but I have a couple things on the water shortage contingency plan.
Okay.
So it requires an analysis of the, is it five consecutive years of drought or five worst years of drought?
It's five consecutive years, and so based on our period of record dating back to 1912 for watershed yield and then consumption information, obviously our watershed data goes back further than that, but our consumption data as compared to watershed yield dates back to 1912. So actually, as far as five consecutive years, the early 30s were actually the five driest consecutive years. So even with our 14 through 16 drought period, with dry and critically dry years, we still didn't have a five-year period that equated to that.
Okay. So we used the 1930s as the benchmark for those five consecutive years.
Correct.
But we're using today's consumption level.
We are using today's consumption, but in addition to today's consumption, you also project out your population increase. Then everything is broken down by use type. So we've got commercial, domestic, irrigation. We actually include raw water in our gross water demand because that's a component of our watershed delivery. So all of those uses are projected out to the year 2045 in five-year increments. The population is increased in five-year increments. And then you, again, analyze all of those things out in those five-year windows. And then...
So even with all of those assumptions, growth and demand, five worst years, we're never under a scenario under that forecast under, you know, where we're shorting our customers.
We are not going to, based on the applied methodology recommended in Water Code for urban water management plan purposes, going to be in a scenario where there is a shortage.
So now my comment for the benefit of the board. There was a change in the law that required these shortage levels 1 through 6, 1 being 10%, 2 being 20%, and so on, up to a greater than 50% reduction. And I'm concerned, so this did not exist in the 14 and 15 drought. And what I think the state is trying to do is kind of a blunt instrument. We want all urban water suppliers in the state to go to drought stage 3 or, you know, whatever. And I just flagged that because under our planning, under the foresight of the, you know, the folks that formed this district, built the storage facilities and so on, you don't have a water shortage problem, you know, in our five driest year period. So, that's something, you know, in the 14 and 15 period, remember the state basically said curtail or reduce by 36%, even though there was no local reason to do that. So I just want to flag that. I can see that becoming an issue even potentially as early as this year.
Sure.
Very likely next year if drought conditions continue, and we'll just have to deal with that if and when it comes to pass.
Okay.
that being another reason why this board will be routinely updated on hydrologic conditions. And thank you, Justin, for pointing that out, that table that kind of forecasts what the drought measures that this board would be apprised of and requested to consider. There's no option for us to not do that. So
legally, Dustin, how does that affect us later on when we think that should not apply to us? That situation doesn't really exist for us, and yet we stated in our plans, aren't we conceding? And back to the State Water Board, they just don't say, they don't say necessarily what has to be in your plan, right? They just say that you have to prepare and submit.
No, it's a little bit of both. There is some, so this is like a square peg round hole type situation. Before this recent update, the mandate from the state was prepare a drought shortage contingency plan. But it wasn't as specific as it is today. Today it says, have shortage levels 1 through 6, have percent shortage up to 10%, up to 20, up to 30, 40, 50, and greater than 50. So that the state has gotten much more descriptive and narrow in what it wants in a water shortage contingency plan. What, and Kristen, you can help me here, but the narrative in the plan basically says we don't think we will ever reach a situation where we have to resort to reductions given our supply situation. But that, I don't see that preventing the state from this one size fits all approach. Everybody go to stage 3 as an example. When they did this in 14 and 15, we responded with a letter that explained that this was not justified given local conditions. We ended up on the state's naughty list, for lack of a better term, you know, as a non-complying entity, but there was never any enforcement action that was brought. So, you know, if this were to happen again, we would need to consider local conditions. We want to communicate with the state. We wouldn't want to necessarily say exactly how we would respond, but, you know, we want to consider our local conditions and the state's mandate. And then we would, you know, in consultation with the board, decide what the appropriate response is. But I did want to flag this issue because I can see this happening as early as this year.
And there's no history of any kind of enforcement mechanism from the state against an entity such as ours. I mean, this is all relatively new, so we're not there yet.
The state did in 14 and 15 when the mandate, it was a tiered conservation mandate up to 36%. There were some enforcement proceedings. I don't believe, I can't say I tracked this really closely because it didn't affect any of our clients, but I do not believe off memory that those enforcement actions ever resulted in a penalty, a financial penalty being applied. But there were certainly public pressure, there was information orders, there was requirements to impose water conservation programs and customer education, and, you know, so it was kind of a progressive discipline type approach that the state took.
But they can come and monitor or check any of our stuff?
I can go back and consult the file. My memory is we sent the letter describing our local supply. There's also a uniqueness to your system in that you have a treated water system and a raw water system. You could cut your, I'm being somewhat facetious here, but you could cut your irrigation season by a couple days and save enough water to provide treated water supply for a covered year. I mean, it's just your demands on irrigation versus treated are so, there's such a difference between the two. So if there truly was ever a shortage, we would just cut the irrigation season by hours or days, and that would produce enough water savings for treated water demands. We explained to the state the uniqueness of your supply situation and the uniqueness of this dual treated raw system. And as I said, the state put us on the list of non-compliant entities, but they never pursued any kind of enforcement action. It was a great letter. I can find it. I was very proud of that.
So, big picture, though, I mean, this ultimately rests with the consumer. If you're going to save any water, they want us to police the consumer. They want us. I mean, where are they going with this big picture vision? We're going to cut the consumer off after X gallon? I mean, how is this ever going to work without the full cooperation of the customer?
Yes, the direction we are heading, and this ties into urban water conservation mandates. They're trying to tighten the system to generate more water for environmental needs and then drought resiliency. And at least in the last drought, they had the calculations of how much water had been saved cumulatively statewide through their conservation mandates. And it was a big number. I don't know if it was accurate, but it was a big number. In many cases, it was totally unnecessary because that savings then just got spilled out of the system in 2017. So, what Aqua and our statewide lobbying associations have been advocating for is get away from the top-down mandate. We can appreciate the state's interest in ensuring that local water providers are resilient in the face of climate change and drought, et cetera. But let us determine locally how we define that resiliency. Let us plan our own drought measures, drought response, and so on. And I would say, thus far, the Newsom administration is much more receptive to that message than the Brown administration was. And that's a good thing, in my opinion. That's a good thing. And that's evident in Newsom's drought proclamations that he's issued thus far. He's issued two. And they've been, the first one was just for Sonoma and Mendocino counties. The second one's a little broader, but it doesn't encompass the entire state, and it also doesn't mandate that water suppliers take certain actions. So thus far, the approach is more regional, less top-down.
Okay.
Yeah, Lake Mendocino, we have friends in UPAC. We talked to them the other day. How's your water over there? They say they can walk across Lake Mendocino. Wow, it's going to get bad.
It's going to get bad at Lake Orville, too.
Yeah, it is.
It's
going to be
better.
The lowest ever. Wow.
When I was a kid in 1977, we used to go to Lake Mendocino every, numerous times a year, and it was down to literally a 2 foot wide ditch through the whole lake, and we could walk across the entire lake bed.
Wow.
Nothing but a 2x2 channel of water flowing through Lake Mendocino.
Ooh.
Very vivid, it's always stuck with me. Destroyed a whole boating season.
Lake Orville.
And then some.
At 2006, we built a bunch of portable docks on Orville Lake for Big Wind Marina. So people who launch boats, they tried and put remedy gas down so they get through the mud. Had a fisherman came out there and tried it, which was just a dead summer.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, let's go ahead and move on.
So real quick on this, Chris, then page 9, middle of the page, 2.2, 10620B, every person that becomes an urban water supplier. And it later refers to every person as an it's. So I'm guessing something's wrong there, either with grammar or something, potentially.
I'm sorry, can you tell me that again? I was trying to find the page.
So page 9, 2.2, mm-hmm. Basics for Preparing a Plan, and then the middle of those, the 10620B, every person that becomes an urban water supplier.
That's a California Water Code, so I cannot modify that language.
Can't change that?
I can double check just to make sure that somehow I didn't.
Somebody should have caught them on that, because I mean, even if they did want to say every person, they shouldn't refer to person as an it. Should have been a they have become. So something's wrong there. And I believe that it's not on your end, Chris, and I believe that's on the state. That would be right in line.
Well, we're good on that topic?
Yep.
Yes, move into director's report.
Mr. President, forgive me. Did we bypass general public participation?
We sure did.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, you went from three to, yeah. Public participation, sorry, public, if you've been hanging on, and
you get a ball.
No public online.
Did you get any on email?
Nothing on email as of 3:52.
My apologies to the public.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Director's report. John, you want to start us off?
It's going to be a long, dry, hot summer for the old up Little Grass Valley. They didn't do a very good job in Lakeville this year, but I think it'll be better next year.
We only drew it down near your cabin.
Oh, we're going to last year. It's still good. I just didn't look hard. No, it's going to be a bad year for everybody. And fires in Google.
So, Todd?
I'd just like to thank staff again for the efficiency and the new processes that are in place. It seems like this just gets better and better as far as progress, fixing our issues, past, you know, long outstanding issues. It looks like, again, the only problem that we have now is the generation of funds. I can just imagine what staff could be doing if we had proper fundage to address everything. So, again, I commend staff on all of that. I was going to talk about COVID a little bit, just this whole mask thing. I think everybody's getting tired of masks, but I'm going to cut my report quite short on that just because I've been promised by the general manager reading this crystal ball that this time it's for real. We're going to be done with masks on June 15th and no more, three more weeks.
Oh boy.
So, you know, I'm pretty excited about that. But one of the things that really freed me from COVID was when I went and got the antigen test from my doctor, the blood test that shows I had COVID, you know, months before at a period that I was isolated and I suspected I had it. So this was really freeing for me because she really even went out on a limb and she said that as somebody that's had COVID, there's no way I can infect anybody or become infected. And she put it all in writing with my antigen test. And even when I flew out of country, no test, no swab, just show the letter and you're free. So this was very liberating for me. So again, I know several people have done it since, and they didn't even know they had COVID, and yet they had the positive antigen, so they clearly had COVID. So just something that I became aware of, I thought I'd like to share that. I was gonna go further with that about, you know, the agency and this mask thing, and all of that, but you know, we're free here in another month or so anyway, so I'll just cut that part of my report short. So I appreciate that. And then the last thing I want to touch on is the water transfer. You know, in the past, like way back, I was really adamantly opposed to water transfers and just that concept of giving somebody else our water. But, you know, the more I became involved with the agency and the more I see, you know, the real impact of water transfers, who needs the water, the fact that the water would just be going to the lake and down the river anyway. And then the fact, just like small business, real business, when you get involved in it and money becomes an issue, you know, you have to make certain changes and adaptive changes to your mindset on things, because it takes money to make all of this happen. And so I'm now excited for this water transfer, the potential it brings for those who get that needed water, and the potential it brings for our agency and the fundage, much needed fundage during these difficult times that it brings. That's it for my report today.
Thank you. Jim?
Oh, I'm okay. I'm just hanging in there right now.
All right.
Yeah, a little bit. I want to thank staff for all the trouble you guys go through wearing these crazy things. And me and my wife had both immunization shots many, many months ago, and we're glad for that. Only thing that I've got is I've had a lot of phone calls from people wanting water. And a lot of them are ditch water. And I want to thank you guys for putting your applications online. And what I see, that's just basically for treated water. And I got questions on what they need to do to get ditch water. They probably have to fill out an application. I didn't see online that they could do this for ditch water, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, with tap set up, as you can select domestic or irrigation, but it may not be intuitive to a new user, so we'll take a look at that.
Yeah.
Internally, it's one and the same. It's just how you select the form.
So what I'll do in the future is refer them to call the office.
That's
I know they need assessor's partial number, and probably they would need a plot plan and a drawing and how many feet they would need to put pipe in or ditch or whatever they have to do.
Well, call, you know, my suggestion is you have them call the main office, and we'll walk through that and determine what APN number they belong to,
yeah.
And then we'll review, we'll actually populate a form and then review whether or not water is immediately available or what would be required.
Yeah, some of them said they see water in the neighborhood, but the one guy is telling him, you got permission for your neighbor, you're probably going to need an easement through your property. It would have to be legal. And I don't know what else, but I think that's a good way to start.
Yeah, but staff will walk right through that because we need to verify that they're either in the district or they need the annex or the road commission. Where's the closest conveyance? All
yeah.
Those things like you just described. So.
Yeah, so I'll talk to them again. Hopefully I can get the good information to them. And then people are scared to death. Their wells are going to go dry. Everything's going to burn up this summer. And what was really funny, I got to thinking, years ago when PG&E cut those trees down on Feather River Boulevard, I went out there and tried to help them guys get it stopped. It was crazy. But what they did, they looked at them old tree stumps, and they counted the rings in them. And I should have wrote it down, but they were saying back in the late 1800s, in 1900s, there was evidence of a huge, huge drought. And this is what scares me. What if we're in for more drought? Wow, it's going to be devastating. I'm just hoping we could all rain dance this next winter and make it rain. That's all I got. Thank you.
Hey, guys. I have no report today. So, any comments before we move into closed session? No comments on that?
Nothing received as of 3:59.
All right. Take a couple minutes of recess and we'll go into closed session. Let's move back into open session.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The announcement, let's see, it's 5:18. The announcement is that direction was given to legal counsel and to real property negotiators. Board, for the real property item, we are nearing conclusion of negotiations with Santa Clara Valley Water District on a potential 2021 water transfer. As was mentioned earlier in open session, we have gone public with a change petition with the State Water Resource Control Board, so we're actively seeking the regulatory approvals to implement the transfer. We have been in negotiations with Santa Clara Valley Water District and have agreed at least as to a term sheet on price and other terms. So we're at a point where we're fairly close on a purchase agreement, and we're recommending that you authorize Rafe as your general manager to execute a purchase agreement once it's in an agreeable form. Since we have not had an opportunity to really dialogue with the public on this proposed 2021 transfer, we would ask that we agendize an informational item in June to discuss and receive any questions on the potential transfer. So I should, last point, and then I'll open it up to questions. By signing the purchase agreement, it does not necessarily commit you to the transfer. First of all, there's the regulatory approvals that you still need. Second, it's a sliding scale in terms of the amount of water that you potentially offer for sale, and that could be from 0 up to 8,000 acre feet. So this is an important step in the transfer consideration, but it's not the final step. Can I answer any questions?
No questions.
No.
So the motion I would recommend is to move authorization and execution of a 2021 water transfer agreement with Santa Clara Valley Water District once it is agreeable to staff and council, and to direct staff to agendize an informational 2021 water transfer discussion to receive and answer questions concerning the proposed 2021 transfer at the agency's regular June board meeting.
So moved. First, or a second?
I have a second.
A second. Any public comments?
Nothing in the email as of 5:21.
Online meeting is closed. Thank you, Jamie and Art. All in favor?
All in favor.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Five ayes.
Okay. Thank you, Board.
Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you. I wish you had more water.